Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Carolina Bartoletto, an activist with the group United We Dream, who discusses what Donald Trump's decision to end DACA will mean to her and nearly 1 million other young immigrants. Angel Candelario, a Burger King employee from Hartford, Connecticut, who talks about why he participated in Labor Day protests with the Fight for 15 movement to demand a living wage and a union. And Robert Bazanko, professor of history at the University of Houston, who examines how unchecked development and deregulation of dangerous industries exacerbated the destruction wrought by Hurricane Harvey in Texas. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Since late August, nearly 60,000 Rohingya Muslim refugees have fled to Bangladesh from Myanmar's growing violence. The ethnic minority Rohingya have faced brutal repression in recent years at the hands of Myanmar's majority Buddhist population. A new wave of violence erupted after a small group of Rohingya insurgents attacked military outposts. Burma's military quickly counterattacked, burning and clearing out Rohingya villages. Thus far, an unknown number of civilians, mostly women and children, have died in violence on the border with Bangladesh. At the same time, Myanmar's elected leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, has ignored the growing refugee crisis and blasted aid groups working on behalf of the Rohingya in Rakhine State, where over 1 million Rohingya live. Over 100,000 refugees now live in camps in Bangladesh, and border guards there have orders to block new refugees from crossing into the country. Burma's army has come under intense international criticism for inflicting horrible abuses on Rohingya civilians during earlier bursts of fighting. A United Nations commission led by former Secretary General Kofi Annan warned that radicalism among the Rohingya would grow if sweeping reforms weren't initiated in the areas of human rights, security, and economic development. Laboratoria, a computer skills training school, runs coding programs in Mexico, Chile, and Peru and recruits ambitious young women to train for high-paying tech jobs that are increasingly in demand across Latin America. The program is now seen as a model for skills training to expand the middle class throughout the Americas. Over 20 million young people have dropped out of school and are now among the ranks of the unemployed. Despite widespread poverty, there is growing demand across the continent for tech-savvy, highly paid web developers. A job interview often only consists of a recruiter asking an applicant to go on a computer and demonstrate their coding skills. The Christian Science Monitor reports that coding programs help break down traditional workplace gender barriers, yet many obstacles remain, such as the expense of childcare. However, there's a big payoff for women who graduate from coding training, where many can earn 3 times their former salary. 4 years ago, President Obama's Attorney General Eric Holder adopted a policy known as Smart on Crime, reforms that directed federal prosecutors to defer using harsh mandatory minimum sentences when dealing with low-level, nonviolent drug offenders. After Ronald Reagan declared his war on drugs, the average sentence for illegal narcotics for an African American was nearly 50% higher than for whites. Mandatory minimum sentences instituted in the 1980s imposed long prison sentences on drug offenders, fueling mass incarceration that increased the prison population to over 2 million in federal, state, and local prisons. After the Obama-Holder reforms were adopted, the number of federal prisoners began to decline. Toward the end of his time in office, President Obama granted clemency to over 1,900 nonviolent federal prisoners who were subject to mandatory minimum sentences. Now, Donald Trump's Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, has reversed course on sentencing reforms. In May, Sessions overturned Holder's reforms on mandatory minimum sentences, claiming without any evidence that Holder's sentencing changes had led to America's sudden 10.8% increase in the murder rate in 2015. However, Sessions' endorsement of failed 1980s crime policies have not gone unopposed, reports the Guardian newspaper. Police chiefs in some of America's largest cities have publicly opposed the policy change, as have some conservative Republican senators. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As long expected, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced on September 5th that the Trump administration is ending the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. The DACA program, initiated by President Obama with an executive order in 2012, benefited immigrants without serious criminal histories who were younger than 16 years old when they arrived in the U.S. before 2007. An estimated 800,000 young undocumented immigrants, 91% of whom are now employed, currently benefit from DACA protections. With this announcement, no new DACA applications will be accepted, but the administration will allow DACA recipients with a work permit set to expire before March 5, 2018, the opportunity to apply for a 2-year extension. Trump's acting Homeland Security Secretary Elaine Duke stated there would be a 6-month delay for current DACA recipients to give Congress time to pass alternative legislation. While making the announcement, Sessions condemned DACA, as Donald Trump often has, labeling it as unconstitutional and unilateral executive amnesty that has taken away hundreds of thousands of jobs from Americans. Your reporter spoke with Carolina Bordoletto, a DACA recipient who came to the U.S. from Brazil when she was 9 years old. Now an activist with a group United We Dream, she discusses what the end of DACA will mean to her and nearly 1 million other young immigrants, and the protest actions organized in response to Trump's decision.
DACA works. It's an excellent program. I think there's a statistic that says that 91% of people who have DACA are currently working, and those who are not working are in school, usually in college. So it's been a program that has really been like a lifeline for a community. It has allowed undocumented people like me to be able to pursue their careers, to get jobs, to support their families. So taking away DACA is really, it's really a cold-hearted decision because it disrupts the lives of, you know, so many immigrant communities, immigrant families, schools, places of worship, employers. But I guess the fact is that we know that this is a possibility since the election, really. This is something that, you know, Trump ran his election on, saying that, you know, he was going to take away DACA. So we've been, not that we've been expecting, but we've been kind of preparing for this since, you know, November 9th, 2016. And the fact that it's, you know, 7 months, I think, after Trump took office and we still have DACA, I think is a testament to both that it's not a politically good decision for him to take away the DACA program, and it's also a testament to the large amount of support that exists for this program, both within the immigrant community and also outside the immigrant community.
Carolina, what kind of preparations have you made in the event DACA is abolished and you yourself face deportation, as well as family members that you arrived here with?
I guess personally, I'm not really sure what I'm going to do, but I do know that no matter what happens, we're going to keep fighting for the rights of immigrant communities, because we always know that DACA was just like a temporary stopgap measure. It's not a law. It's just an executive order. So we've known it was temporary, so we're going to still keep fighting for more.
What will the fight look like? What kind of preparations has your group locally and the National United We Dream organization made to defend DACA as the Trump administration moves to close it down?
Well, here in Connecticut, we've been trying to get our elected officials to show their public support for DACA. A few weeks ago, we got all the Connecticut delegation, Murphy Blumenthal and the five congresspeople, to sign on to a letter in support of DACA that was addressed to then-Secretary of Homeland Security, John Kelly, asking him to keep the DACA program in place. And then we also got the Attorney General to voice his support for DACA and sign on to a letter saying that he would like to keep the DACA program in place.
And I've heard that preparations are being made for a massive fast is being planned in Washington, D.C., as well as protests, rallies, and vigils across the country to bring attention on this issue. Tell us a little bit more about that, if you could.
Yes. So tomorrow, actually, about 40 or so of our undocumented youth and allies are going to get on a bus at like 4 a.m. and go down to Washington, D.C. for a National Day of Action to defend DACA. So there'll be a large rally followed by some smaller actions that our youth are going to take part in tomorrow. And tomorrow also begins a week-long fast that some organizations are organizing down in Washington, D.C. They're going to be fasting for 5 days to show their support for DACA and to show the moral crisis that taking away DACA will cause for communities. And I do believe this is a week of action down there in Washington, D.C., so we're sending people down there for the whole week, and they're going to do actions at members of Congress offices and try to meet with their members of Congress to keep pushing for a legislative solution.
You know, there's been a lot of attention on white supremacist groups, the KKK, the Nazis, a lot of hateful organizations who've been emboldened by Donald Trump's election to the presidency. Carolina, what are the links in your mind between this drive by the president to abolish DACA and white supremacy that seems to have come out of the shadows since the election?
I think the effort to end DACA is really just a step forward in the white supremacist agenda of this administration. Because you know, a lot of people who benefit from DACA are people of color. So by saying that, you know, you want to take away this program and potentially deport people, what you're saying is that, you know, immigrants, especially immigrants who are of color, don't belong in this country, and they need to be taken out. So I think that the criticism of DACA, which is such an economically successful program, really has its roots in xenophobia and white supremacy.
That was Carolina Bordoletto, a DACA recipient, an activist with the group United We Dream, and co-founder of Connecticut Students for a Dream. Find links to groups across the U.S. campaigning to defend DACA by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Along with more than 300 other cities across the U.S., Hartford, Connecticut hosted a Fight for 15 march and rally on Labor Day. About 200 fast food workers, other low-paid employees and their allies, rallied in front of a McDonald's restaurant, then marched 2 miles past many more fast food franchises, and held a rally in front of a downtown church, where workers from the food, daycare, and home care sectors talked about the need for a livable wage and a union. The National Workers Alliance, known as Fight for 15, was founded in 2012 and backed by the Service Employees International Union, which has initiated other successful organizing drives, including the Justice for Janitors campaign. With their Labor Day rallies, Fight for 15 is launching a campaign to defeat anti-worker politicians across the U.S. in 2018. While attending the Hartford Fight for 15 rally, Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus met Angel Candelario, a 37-year-old Burger King employee. He explained how it's impossible for him to support his family on Connecticut's minimum wage of $10.10 an hour, especially when, like most fast food workers, he doesn't work full time. He recounts that although he was hired 7 months ago at 20 hours a week, he has since seen his hours cut in half. Here, Candelario, who has suffered from leukemia since the age of 8, talks about why he became active in the Fight for 15 movement and the importance of having the right to join and be represented by a union.
Because I started standing up for myself and fighting for my rights and actually believing in everything with this movement. And now that my management knows about me and this movement, they're not pleased with it. So now my hours got cut from 20 to 10, and I only get 5 hours each day for only 2 days a week.
Is this the only job you have?
Right now, yes. At one point, I was doing the temp agency job. I was working installations and then Burger Kings, but due to my health issues and difficulties, I'm not able to. So I had to reduce to just one job.
So how are you surviving?
I'm not. If I was to say yeah, I'll be lying to you. But I'm not surviving. I'm actually just living off my sister or my mom, my ex-girlfriend. So That's the truth.
How does that feel to you?
Degrading. At the end of the day, it's degrading. It's it hurts, you know, man's pride, you know that good stuff. You know, a man's thing, a man's ego. But right now with this fight, it's like they got my back, though. They made me feel like, yo, it's all right. You have to stand for something. If not, you're going to fall for every single thing that throws at you in life. So for today, I'm standing for everybody, not just for myself. I'm standing for the people that was afraid to come because they might get in trouble with their job. But it's going to be all right. It's going to be all right.
First of all, if you could get paid full like for 40 hours a week, $15 an hour, do you think that would be an acceptable salary to live on?
Yes. Let's think about it, though. Our movement is called Fight for 15 and Union. If you give us, if they say, okay, Connecticut, here's $15, but it's still, we don't have union, the management still has the rights and take the hours from you. So they'll be like, here's one day of work a week, $15 an hour, 8 hours. What then? So we want that union because the union is guaranteeing us safety. The union is going to treat us like a family. The union is going to pay attention to our hours. The union is going to make sure that once we sign that dotted line to get a job, we're going to get 30 hours, nothing less but better.
Is there a specific union that you're wanting to join?
If I was to join a union, whatever union and so forth, it's a blessing. To pick one, I didn't even know we could pick one. But if we could start our own and have our own backbone, because we not understand. Eight months ago, I wasn't part of this. I was afraid to even speak to the union because at my job, I was taught to walk away from the union. Don't sign with the union. Don't interact with the union. You're capable of getting fired if you interact with the union.
Which is illegal for them to say.
But because us men and women today don't have the proper knowledge on what is what. On what is the rules and regulations that is happening behind them closed doors. What we can or cannot do, what can you say. Who can we talk to and go above any proper chain of command? So now I'm like, I would love to create our own union. That's your answer. That's my answer.
And what other businesses or fast food places are represented here? You work at Burger King, and what are some of the other ones?
We have McDonald's. We have Burger King's. We have Wendy's. We have Taco Bell. We got under the table restaurant workers. We have people from car washes. We have secretary dentists. They want to believe in this. We have medical people that want to come over here and protest with us.
Okay. You said you had health issues. Are you getting under the Affordable Care Act? Do you have any health insurance or anything?
Under the Affordable Care Act, I have Husky. Burger King's offers medical. But if you sign this piece of paper waiving your medical rights, we can make sure that you get over 30 hours a week. That's what I was told. Excuse me. But me being a young man, naive, I signed. So now I don't get no medical, nothing. My medical's weak, and my hours are weak.
This is Burger King told you if you signed a waiver?
There's a make a waiver. If you sign this piece of paper, we could guarantee you over 30 hours because we can really give you benefits and also provide you 40 hours. But, you know, I bit the bullet because I didn't understand. I was naive. I was still immature into this rules and regulations. But now that I understand, I bet you it won't happen to the next person. I won't allow it.
Tell me, if you talk with your fellow workers, can you talk about any of the other struggles that some of your fellow workers have had to deal with making only $10.10 an hour?
I come up with a mind in my mind. There's a gentleman, a young gentleman, that I was working with at a restaurant under the table. Great pay because it's under the table. We get the cash, you know? But this gentleman lost a tooth. And plus, he's illegal, undocumented. And because of that, he can't go to a regular dentist. He has to pay cash to get seen as a favor because of his situation, legal situations. So that's just one of the medical. It's almost impossible. It's unbelievable. You know, that people get hurt and you can't get work compensation. You get hurt, you can't complain about it to your boss because then they're so what? What are you going to do? Either you get fired or suck it up. Or he'll give you one day off.
Without pay.
Without pay. So I want to tell everybody that this is what the fight. If you ever had a fight that you want to stand up for in your life, anything, one moment, one day, Fight for 15 is the movement.
That was Angel Candelario, a Burger King employee from Hartford, Connecticut, who marched with the Fight for 15 movement on Labor Day. Learn more about Fight for 15 by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Hurricane Harvey was a Category 4 storm when it slammed the southeast Texas coast on August 25th. But when Harvey downgraded to a less powerful tropical storm, it then dumped torrential rains that flooded the region with a record 52 inches in some areas. After countless homes were flooded, more than 53,000 Texans were forced to seek shelter with the aid of the Federal Emergency Management Agency. According to news reports, FEMA expects nearly 1 million applications for aid stemming from Hurricane Harvey. Houston, America's fourth largest city, is now drying out. But municipal, state, and federal officials say that it will take years to fully recover from the storm that killed 60. While President Trump has asked Congress for an initial $7.9 billion for Harvey recovery efforts, Texas Governor Greg Abbott estimated that the cost of recovery could be as high as $180 billion. Your reporter spoke with Robert Bazanko, professor of history at the University of Houston, who examines how the absence of zoning laws, unchecked development, and deregulation of the fossil fuel and chemical industries in Houston contributed to the scale of the destruction wrought by Hurricane Harvey and endangered public health.
In 2001, Tropical Storm Allison, which was the worst until this one hit. After Tropical Storm Allison, between 2001 and 2010, in that decade, 167,000 acres of green space were plowed under and turned into asphalt. And so that's really kind of the way Houston kind of reckons with these things. We have more, they keep using the word development. I don't like that word. I think it's Orwellian. But, you know, you can see maps. You know, the News to Local paper had maps of Houston, you know, over the last 5 years, the last 10 years, the last 15 years, the last 20 years, and areas where there was once, you know, parks or green space or whatever, which are now basically concrete. So there's nowhere for the water to go. There are two reservoirs west of town, Addix and Barker, and those are both rated 1, which is the lowest rating by the Corps of Engineers. In both cases, they were ready to break, and they had to do controlled releases and deliberately flood neighborhoods in order to avoid them breaking, which would have been utterly cataclysmic. When these things happen, you hear a lot of, you know, kind of hand-wringing and, you know, people, you know, alarm, but nothing gets done. And in fact, the regulations, it becomes even easier to build, and you see more construction and strip malls, you know, big apartment buildings and townhouses and things like that going up. So if you look at the data, if you look at the topography, we actually have a lot less, you know, green now than we did, even though these storms get incrementally worse. It's a recipe for greater disaster, obviously.
I've read that the city of Houston, the fourth largest city in America, has no zoning regulations, that there is just unchecked development as far as the eye can see, with no restrictions, you know, for floodplains and other mm-hmm. critical infrastructure that most cities take into account when allowing buildings to go up in certain parts, vulnerable parts
yeah,
of the city.
I mean, it's true. Usually when you read these, you take them with a grain of salt, but it's true. There's no zoning. There's really no regulation. No one's unaware of the problem here, and there's an outcry about it in the immediate aftermath of these, and then they just kind of get stopped. It's, I call it cowboy capitalism here in Texas. You know, the government's bad. We don't want people telling us what to do. We don't want regulations. It's going to cost us jobs, you know. Texas has touted itself as different and kind of an economic miracle. And, you know, a lot of times when the rest of the country is suffering really bad economic downturns, they're less severe here. But that kind of becomes the excuse to do nothing because things are going well. And if we start caving into tree huggers, we're going to lose jobs and the economy is not going to be as good. And so nothing, and then inertia sets in and nothing gets done. And, you know, it's like the old joke, right? You know, if you got a hole in your roof, you know, when it's raining, you can't fix it. And when it's dry, it's as good as anybody's roof. So that's kind of the way they look at things.
Wow. There are these 8 trailers of organic peroxides that we've all been reading mm-hmm. about that have caught on fire, and
right.
extremely noxious and toxic smoke is going far and wide around the town of Crosby there. Then Lieutenant Governor Abbott, who's now serving as the Texas governor, had put in place some regulations that
allowed chemical companies like Arkema to keep secret what
yes,
they have
yes,
in their
exactly.
chemical plants. And my question is, you've got a lot of people living in this region who are, they themselves or their children are being exposed to this, yet the government and these corporations are conspiring with each other to keep it secret and not allowing some kind of transparency so people can protect themselves. It seems another case where self-interest is being trumped by corporate interests.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know what to say. Even the first responders, you know, when they first got there, they didn't know what to expect. So about 21, I think, in the first wave, we ended up in the emergency ward of the local hospital. They're unaware of what's going on. I mean, you know, I don't know who owns it, but I'm pretty sure it's a French company, so the owners probably are in Paris. But, you know, even the local managers probably don't live next to the plant. And it's just not in their interest. I mean, I think if all of these 500 facilities told everybody in the neighborhoods where they're located what was there, I mean, I think a lot more people would be a lot more concerned. And, you know, but the governor, as you said, after the explosion of West Texas, actually, you know, made it easier for them to withhold this information. And, you know, once you toxic chemicals are emitted into water, you know, they can go anywhere. They're not confined. But, you know, we always say, you know, well, this is the one that's going to force people to act. And, you know, let's hope it does. But if you lived in Texas, I've been there for over 20 years now. I've heard that many times. I heard it after Allison in 2001. Well, we're going to have to do something now. And, you know, actually what they did was pave up even more land, you know, in the interest of these corporations, especially the petroleum and the chemical industries, which are, you know, I mean, this is one of the most industrialized cities in the world and really the kind of the world capital for what they call energy. You would think in their own self-interest, right, to maintain their own stability, they would do something. Maybe this time they will, but we've heard this before, you know, those of us who've lived there.
That was Robert Bazanko, professor of history at the University of Houston. Find more analysis and commentary on how Houston's unchecked development and lax regulations exacerbated the destruction wrought by Hurricane Harvey by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WOOL in Bellows Falls, Vermont, KHOI in Ames, Iowa, KKRN in Round Mountain, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.